Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're crushing morning miles or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
Hey guys, and welcome to Mysteries and Histories with me, your host, Georgia Marie. This podcast is adapted from my YouTube channel, and this episode is part of my Vault series, where I'm turning my back catalogue into podcasts. So, if I ever reference photos or things on screen, please remember that these episodes were originally made for video. Also, if research or references seem out of date, please bear in mind as well that some of these episodes were recorded as far back as 2016. I just want to make sure that all of my content is available on podcast as well for you to enjoy. If you wish to find me on YouTube, I am just Georgia Marie over there, and with all my disclaimers out of the way, enjoy the episode. Hey guys, and welcome back to my channel for another video in my Serial Killer Spotlight series, where today we're going to be talking about the notorious Yorkshire Ripper, Peter Sutcliffe, who in 1981 was found guilty of murdering 13 women and attempting to murder 7 others. He was given 20 concurrent life sentences, but in 2010 this was converted to a whole life order. He was never to be released. Peter Sutcliffe, to put it lightly, was a nasty piece of work. I say was because he finally died in just November of last year. His crimes were amongst some of the most violent I've ever covered on this channel. The moniker the Yorkshire Ripper was inspired directly by Jack the Ripper, as the crimes were so reminiscent. The search for the Yorkshire Ripper was one of the largest and most expensive manhunts in British history, and it led to a huge criticism of the West Yorkshire Police. Over the course of their investigation, they interviewed him 9 times and missed the signs every single one of those times. In the end, he was caught pretty much by chance. He murdered 13 women and seriously injured many more. As his moniker suggests, the majority of these crimes took place in the county of Yorkshire in England, in Leeds, Bradford, Huddersfield, Halifax, and even a couple of attacks a bit further away in Manchester. Peter Sutcliffe was born prematurely on the 2nd of June 1946 to Kathleen and John Sutcliffe. He was one of 6 children and their firstborn son. John was said to have been really excited to have a son. He was looking forward to sharing his love of the pub and any type of sport with him. He wanted a man's man kind of son. But to his father's dismay, that would not be the type of man that Peter would become. From birth, he was incredibly clingy, preferring the company of his mother to anyone else. He was said to be a shy, quiet boy who preferred to stay inside with his mum than go out and play in the mud with his siblings. He is repeatedly described as a loner as a child, and he was made fun of growing up for his very small stature. John very much resented his son for all of this, but Kathleen was said to be a kind, loving woman who had more than enough love to go around. She adored her son, and luckily she would never live to find out who he was to become. You often find that many serial killers had highly abusive childhoods, and whilst Peter clearly had the love of his mother, his brother Carl told Yorkshire Live in 2020 that their father was an incredibly violent man and an alcoholic. He once smashed a pint glass over Peter's head on Christmas Day over something completely trivial. John would regularly beat his children and was also said to be a womaniser, cheating on Kathleen constantly. It seems that Kathleen also cheated on John at one point and went out for drinks with this other man, but John found out and marched to this hotel that she was in with this other man, with their now sort of late teenage young adult children in tow, and lost it in front of the children. Peter never showed any signs of mental illness as a child, but no doubt his father's violence may have left a lasting impression on him. He ended up dropping out of school around the age of 15 and took on a series of menial jobs from there, one of which was notably a job as a gravedigger. It's said that during this time as a gravedigger, he developed a very dark, macabre sense of humour. People thought that at the time it was just a coping mechanism to get him through the job, but perhaps that's just what he liked. In 1971, at the age of 25, he got a job on the packaging line for Baird Television before being promoted to a travelling salesman position. He kind of got a knack for travelling around, and after this he gets a job as an HGV driver, a job which he would continue doing all the way through his crimes until his arrest in 1981. His first lorry driving job was for Britannia Works Vanderton, but when he was caught stealing tyres, he got fired. He got a new job at T&WH Clark, which is where he would continue to work for many years. No one at his workplace ever suspected him of being the violent man that he was. In fact, no one in his life at all suspected it. He never showed any signs of violence. He was a completely normal guy as far as everyone was aware. He was even married, marrying his girlfriend of 7 years, Sonia Selsma, in 1974. Sonia was the only girlfriend that Sutcliffe ever had. She worked as a supply teacher, and one night a week she worked as an auxiliary nurse, with Sutcliffe later claiming that the majority of his murders were committed on the nights that she was working. Their marriage wasn't an easy one by any means. They were never able to have children, with Sonia suffering several miscarriages in their time together, and this very much put a strain on their relationship, leading Sonia to at one point apparently cheat on him with an ice cream van driver. But all in all, his home life was relatively normal, but this was not a reflection of who he truly was. Just 1 year after he married Sonia, his attacks as the Yorkshire Ripper would actually begin. But his first ever attack happened in 1969, 6 years earlier, an attack that he actually got a slap on the wrist for from the police, and it's known now as a stone and sock attack. Actually, I should say, this is the first attack that we kind of know of, but the details are disputed, so take it all with a pinch of salt. So this is said to have happened early on in his relationship with Sonia. They were going on regular dates and were described as being in a serious relationship by this point. But when Sonia was spotted with another man one night, Peter got very upset and decided to get his revenge by going with a sex worker. He found a woman who was doing business and they agreed on a price of £5, to which Peter gave her a £10 note, expecting change. He said of this incident, "I thought I would have intercourse with the prostitute, but I changed my mind when it got to the stage where we had to go do it. We were on the way to her place and were talking, and I realised what a coarse and vulgar person she was. We were practically there and I realised I didn't want anything to do with her. Before getting out of the car, I was trying to wriggle out the situation, but I felt stupid as well." He ended up telling the woman that he didn't want to go through with it and asked for his change, to which he said he'd have to take her back to the garage where he picked her up to get it. So he drove her back, but she never gave him his change. Two men threatened him to leave, so he did, humiliated and embarrassed. 3 weeks later, he saw this same woman again in the pub and approached her, asking for his money back and telling her to right the situation, but she just laughed in his face. So, a few weeks later, Peter Sutcliffe's first ever attack took place. He was sitting in a minivan on St Paul's Road in Bradford with his good friend at the time, Trevor Birdsall. Abruptly, he gets out of the van and begins to walk up the road and out of sight. 10 minutes later, he reappears, out of breath, and tells Trevor to drive off quickly. He claimed to his friend that he'd followed a woman, a sex worker, to a house somewhere, and had hit her in the back of the head with a stone in a sock. The next day, two police officers appeared at his home after the woman noted the number plate of the minivan. Sutcliffe admitted that he'd assaulted the woman but claimed that he'd hit her with his hand, not a stone. So he was given a slap on the wrist, but was told that he was lucky because the woman wasn't interested in pressing charges. It wouldn't exactly look good for her as she was a sex worker. As far as we know, or as far as Sutcliffe has admitted to, this seems to be the birth of Sutcliffe's lifelong hatred for sex workers. It seemed to consume him, intent on destroying the lives of as many people as possible from there on out. All because he was apparently duped out of £10. This kind of psychology really fascinates me. Most people get duped out of tenner and think, that's annoying, hold a grudge for a bit, and then move on. Most people would not form a lifelong hatred of sex workers and go on to attack and murder 13. But clearly, it must go deeper than that. Some people speculate this really began with his mother, as it always does. This woman that he idolised fell off the pedestal he held her on when she had an affair and his father exposed it. He also witnessed domestic violence throughout his childhood and was raised as Catholic, with strong views on what women should be. He went through all of this in his childhood and young adult years, but so did his siblings. What was it exactly that made Peter the one to go on and become a serial killer? It must be some form of predisposition, something in his brain that differs from others. I just find psychology so fascinating. This was a callous, sexually sadistic serial killer. He didn't care about the pain he caused. He wanted to cause pain. He hated sex workers with a burning passion, and he was fueled by this hatred. The first attack, which comes under the sort of moniker of the Yorkshire Ripper, happened in July 1975 with the attack of Anna Rogalski. She was known as Irish Annie, having been born as Anna Brosnan in Ireland before moving to Yorkshire when she was 15 to live with her sister. There, she meets Roman Rogalski, marrying him when she was just 21. The marriage would last for 18 years before they eventually divorced in 1973. She was described as being beautiful with an open, warm, childlike manner, but she lost her confidence after the divorce. She ended up in a very difficult relationship with a man called Jeffrey Hughes, which was flecked with violence. One night she went out to see her friends, but when she returned home, she found that Jeff had moved out and taken her brand new kitten with him. She was furious, so she walked to his other house to confront him. On her walk there, she was stopped by a man who asked her if she fancied it, to which she replied, "Not on your life," and just continued on her walk. She thought nothing more of it. When she got to Jeff's house, she found that he was out, so she took off her shoe and broke his window in anger before walking back home. She walked back home through an alleyway at the end of the terrace. It was there that she was attacked by the man who had propositioned her before. She was attacked from behind. Anna was discovered bleeding but alive in the alleyway at 2:20 a.m. She was rushed to hospital where shards of bone had to be removed from her brain in a very intense brain operation. She had been attacked with a heavy object from behind and had defensive bruising on her arms and grazes on her abdomen. There was no evidence to show that she had been sexually assaulted. Despite miraculously surviving her injuries, Anna had no memory of her attacker and couldn't share what he looked like. It turns out that Anna only survived because a neighbour had disturbed him and he fled the scene. She would struggle with anxiety for a long time after this, scared to leave the house and scared of men. She never had another relationship. She even stopped being able to visit the hairdressers because no one could ever hide their shock at the extent of the injuries to her skull. Anna sadly died in 2008, aged just 75, and the attack changed the course of her life forever. Even though not every victim of the Ripper ended up dying, it doesn't mean they all lived fantastic lives afterwards. Anna said, "I've been afraid to go out much because I feel people are staring and pointing at me. This whole thing is making my life a misery. I sometimes wish I'd died in the attack." It's important to note that Anna was not a sex worker. She was just a woman walking alone at night. Whilst the majority of the Ripper victims were sex workers, he didn't always discriminate. The next victim who had also managed to survive was 46-year-old Olive Smelt. She was employed as an office cleaner and was happily married with three children, described at a later date as a respectable housewife. You're going to hear that word respectable a lot in this video. You tended to have two kinds of women who were victims of the Ripper. You had these undeserving, respectable women, or you had the woman of the night, the good time girls. For whatever reason, Sutcliffe seemed convinced that Olive was the latter. He would later say that he was sure she was a sex worker. On the night of her attack, Olive was in the Royal Oak pub in the centre of Halifax having drinks with her friends. It was in this pub that Sutcliffe was hanging out with Trevor Birdsall that night. Olive hadn't been there very long, she was just popping in for a drink before closing time, and then decided to go to a fish and chip shop near her home in Boothtown so she could take supper home to her husband. At about 11:30 p.m, Olive was dropped off in the lay-by next to the chippy by her friends. Sutcliffe and Birdsall just happened to be driving past when Sutcliffe remarked, "That's the prostitute we saw in the pub." Why he was so convinced Olive was a sex worker, I'm not so sure. Perhaps his hatred was so big that he saw every woman as a sex worker. The later Byford report, which was this big look into the investigation for the Yorkshire Ripper, we'll talk about it in more detail later on in the video, stated of this attack on Olive Smelt that Birdsall accompanied Sutcliffe to Halifax on the evening of his attack on Olive Smelt, although there is no suggestion that he either participated in the attack or was even aware of it at the time. At some point, Sutcliffe stopped the car. Birdsall said he saw Sutcliffe put his hand down the side of the seat and said he was going to talk to somebody. He went around the back of the car and didn't appear to go in the same direction as Olive. But really, he went down a parallel alley to the one that she was walking down and met her down the end. He caught up to her, mentioning something about the weather as he passed her by, before striking her on the head with a hammer he'd just picked up in his car. Sutcliffe also slashed her twice on the top of her buttocks, but was disturbed by the headlights of the car coming down the road. He returned to the car where Trevor was waiting for him after about 10 to 20 minutes, and apparently he was unusually quiet, saying he'd just been talking to a woman. Luckily, Olive was soon found in the alleyway and was rushed to hospital, where she had emergency brain surgery and spent 10 whole days. She described her attacker as about 30, 5'10" in height, slightly built, with dark hair and some beard or growth on his face. Trevor Birdsall would read about the attack on Olive Smelt in the paper just a couple of days later, and whilst he was aware that Sutcliffe had left the car that night around that time, he said he found it hard to believe that he, as a friend of mine, could be the man the police were looking for. I think it was denial on Birdsall's part more than anything else. He was aware of the situation and failed to say something. I don't want to come across like I'm blaming Birdsall for Sutcliffe's actions at all, because no one is responsible except Sutcliffe himself, but you can't help but wonder what could have been different if Birdsall had just told the police of his suspicions back then. He would eventually go to them, but it was all just a little bit too little too late. Sutcliffe would later say in a statement which was read out in court during his trial, "I saw her in the Royal Oak. She annoyed me, probably in some minor way. I took her to be a prostitute. I hit her on the head and scratched her buttocks with a piece of hacksaw blade or maybe a knife. My intention was to kill her, but I was disturbed by a car coming down the road." He said he fully intended to kill her, but just didn't get the chance. "She fell down. I was going to kill her. I had the knife with me at that time. I was going to kill her, but I did not get the chance. Consequently, I did it with Trevor still in the car. I knew it was my mission. I heard voices, echoes. Sometimes it was the voice, sometimes an echo. Sometimes it was very clear, sometimes not." Olive Smelt died unexpectedly in 2011, aged 82, at Huddersfield Royal Infirmary. Her family said that she never fully recovered from the attack and relied heavily on them for support for the rest of her life. She struggled to be around her husband or any man, and it put a huge strain on her marriage. Her daughter, Julie Lowry, said to the Halifax Courier, "She never got over that night in 1975. She did well to survive and had to learn to accept what happened mentally, but physically her mobility was never the same. She has been through hell and suffered in pain and silence. She never complained." Olive's case wouldn't be connected to the Ripper case until the late 70s. The next victim, who also luckily survived, was just 14 years old, Tracy Brown. It was August 27th, 1975, when Tracy went with her sister Mandy to visit friends on the other side of Silsden, which was a village near Bradford where they lived. Their usual curfew was 10:15 p.m, but they were allowed to stay out half an hour later that day. As they started the half an hour walk back home, they decided to take a shortcut through the park as it wasn't pitch black yet. It was the middle of summer and the nights were significantly lighter. Once in the park, Tracy stopped to talk to some friends whilst Mandy walked up ahead. Realising their sister was so far ahead, Tracy left her friends and started to walk home to catch up with her, but she had to sit on a rock to remove her shoes as they were rubbing. At this point, a man appears who she describes as having a beard, afro-style hair and dark eyes, almost black. The man didn't really acknowledge her at first, but soon they're walking in step and the man makes conversation, asking Tracy her name and saying that his was Tony Jennis. He asked her if she had a boyfriend, but she said that she didn't feel uncomfortable with him at any point. She just kind of assumed he was a local man, but did note that he never took his hands out of his pockets. They walked together for about 30 minutes, a whole mile, but Tracy never felt intimidated or in danger, until she turned to walk down towards her home, at which point he lunged at her. She said, "The first blow sent me crashing down on my knees. I fell into the side of the road. I pleaded with him, please don't, and screamed for help. But he hit me 5 times and with so much force and energy that each blow was accompanied by a brutal grunting noise. The only reason she survived was because a car came driving past, and when Sutcliffe heard it coming, he picked her up and dropped her over a barbed wire fence. Tracy was able to stand, although she was very disorientated. She managed to make her way just about to a local farmhand, Fred Hargreaves' caravan, where she knocked on the door, covered head to waist in blood. She could barely speak, but Fred led her home to her parents, where she was rushed to hospital. Neurosurgeons operated on her for 5 whole hours. As she'd spent so much time with her attacker, Tracy was able to give a fairly detailed description of him. I remembered his taupe-coloured V-neck jumper over a light blue open-neck shirt and dark brown trousers which had slit pockets at the front rather than the side. I told the policeman he was 5'8", had very dark, almost black Afro-type hair and a full beard. Peter Sutcliffe had attacked 3 or 4 women by this point and failed with his intention each time. We can assume that he intended to murder each of them but got interrupted every time. He wasn't going to let it happen again, especially after Tracy had been able to give such a detailed description of him. Sutcliffe spent an extended period of time with Tracy before he attacked her, which suggests to me that he fully intended to kill her because he knew she'd be able to identify him. He didn't sneak up from the shadows behind her like he had the others. Tracy just got lucky. Tracy's case didn't get officially linked with the Ripper investigation for years. The Chief Constable, Ronald Gregory, later said in his memoir, "Tracy was not a prostitute. We thought at the time she was hit with a piece of wood and all the other attacks were in city areas." Although it seems that Tracy was actually hit with a hammer. As time went on and the Ripper attacks were in the forefront of the news, Tracy became convinced it was the same man who'd attacked her. After seeing a photo fit of this man the authorities believed to be the Yorkshire Ripper, she went to the local police station, but the constable there literally just laughed at her. Her mother even called her uncle, who was a local magistrate and a personal friend of the chief superintendent who was dealing with the Ripper case. But no progress was made to link her attack with the Ripper series. This is important for so many reasons, because Tracy, unlike Olive and Anna, remembered her attacker very, very well. She spent an extended period of time with him. She could describe him accurately, and she was able to make a very good photo fit of her attacker. The police never reissued this photo fit, although it did show a striking resemblance to Sutcliffe. In 1992, Sutcliffe finally admitted to this attack. The next victim wouldn't be as lucky as Tracy to survive. 28-year-old Wilma McCann was mother of 4 children, originally from Scotland. Her murder, as with so many of the other victims in this case, was a product of her terrible circumstances she found her life in. She was living in abject poverty after her abusive husband left, forcing them to move to Leeds. The news reports would later depict Wilma as an alcoholic, a promiscuous woman who would use men for money. Many people living in Yorkshire in the 70s were dealing with very similar scenarios, living in poverty, unable to feed themselves and their families, so you did what you had to do to get by. Wilma's children remembered her as a caring, loving mother. She would ensure there was a hot dinner on the table every evening and never once raised a hand to her children. She was always full of love and kindness. But she did have a rotation of some not-so-kind boyfriends who were in and out of the house constantly. On the night of the 29th of October 1975, Wilma had planned to go out, but she'd been unable to find a babysitter. She left the kids at home alone that night at around 7:30 p.m. to head to the pub. She was seen in a number of different pubs that night, the Regent, the Scotsman, the White Swan, the Royal Oak, and finally the Room at the Top, consuming 12 to 14 measures of spirits in the hours before her death. She's said to have left the Room at the Top at around 1 a.m. on October 30th, chips and curry sauce in hand. She wasn't too far from home, but she attempted to hitchhike a lift. She did manage to stop a lorry driver who stopped to give her a lift, but when he realised just how drunk she was, he declined and headed on his journey alone. Unlucky for Wilma, the next person to stop for her was none other than Peter Sutcliffe. She jumped into his car, asking him if he wanted business, code for sex. She told him it would cost him a fiver, and they stopped near the Prince Philip playing fields, only about 100 yards from her home where her children were waiting for her. But she would never make it that far. Her body was found the next morning at 7:40 a.m. by the milkman and his younger brother, thinking at first it was just an abandoned Guy Fawkes or a bundle of rags. Wilma was lying on her back, her trousers pulled down to her knees and her bra lifted, exposing her breasts. Her hair was matted with blood and she'd been stabbed in the lower abdomen, chest and neck. She'd been hit in the head with a hammer before Sutcliffe took a knife to her body. He later said that he wanted to make certain she was dead, stabbing her in the lung and throat intentionally. He then just drove back to his mother-in-law's house where he was living at the time, saying he was scared and thought that he was bound to get caught for this. But he just washed his hands and went to bed. In his confession with the police from January 4th, 1981, he said, "After that first time, I developed and built up a hatred for prostitutes in order to justify within myself the reason why I'd attacked and killed Wilma McCann. But I don't believe that for a second. His hatred of sex workers, of women, long predated this attack." In another confession later that very same month, he said, "I may have given the impression by what I've said to her and what she replied, the intent was to have sex, but this was not the case. This kind of talk was just a preamble leading up to the true purpose of my killing her. It was my idea to get her to go up a distance up the field. This is a man who knew what he was doing the entire time." Wilma's children would realise something was wrong the next morning when they woke up and realised she wasn't home yet. Two of the children left the house to go and see if they could find her, but instead they just saw a commotion nearby. Little did they know, the commotion was caused by the discovery of their mum's body. Soon the children were taken to a local children's home where they were told that their mum had been taken to heaven. The children stayed in care for a while whilst their father Jerry was located and paperwork for him to be given full custody was completed. Wilma's family in Scotland were desperate to take the children, knowing that Jerry was a violent man, but the kids went to him anyway. Of course, Jerry hadn't changed over the years at all, and he just continued his violence and abuse when the children came back to live with him. The effects of murders such as this go so much further than just the death of a victim. Families, friends, and loved ones are affected. The ripple effect makes a difference to the rest of their lives. There weren't only 13 victims of the Ripper, but 25 children of these victims and more. An investigation into Wilma's obvious murder began immediately, with thousands of posters distributed in the local area, along with a thorough search of her home. An examination of her body and clothes revealed semen found in her trousers and underwear, which belonged to a non-secretor, a person whose blood type wasn't secreted in their bodily fluids. Her death wouldn't really hit national headlines, but the local media did note that she had several boyfriends, even though the police were very careful not to reveal too much about her personal life. Wilma was said to be promiscuous, said to exchange sex for money, and this would change how the police, the media, and the public responded to her case, and would set the tone for how this entire Ripper investigation would be received. As soon as the media got wind of Wilma being promiscuous, a possible sex worker, her life was deemed less important than others. She was a good time girl, she was a woman of loose morals, she deserved what was coming to her. What did she expect leading the kind of life that she did? In fact, the Ripper case wasn't taken seriously at all until the first innocent victim was killed. To this day, Wilma's son Richard is still trying to get an official apology from the West Yorkshire Police for their treatment and description of some of the victims. They insinuated on many an occasion that some of the victims had doubtful morals and therefore the crimes were expected. But of course, no one deserves to die in the way these victims did. I'm not going to be going into full details of the kind of injury that some of these women received, as I feel it's a bit gratuitous. You can imagine how terrible it is without me going into graphic detail. The next victim was 42-year-old Emily Jackson in January 1976. She was from Cherwell near Morley and was a mother of three who'd had a pretty hard life recently. She lost her 14-year-old son 7 years before in 1969 in a freak accident, and her husband was abusive. She left him a couple of times, even starting divorce proceedings at one point and moving in with another man, but they always ended up getting back together. After their son's death, they decided that life was too short and they wanted to live life to the fullest, but eventually financial pressures started to take their toll. Sydney, her husband, was a roofing contractor and Emily helped with the business, doing the paperwork and driving him from job to job since he didn't drive, But towards the end of 75, the company was on the brink of bankruptcy. They didn't have enough money to feed the family, let alone live life to the fullest like they'd promised after the death of their son. So Emily decided to start doing sex work. It was a sacrifice that she was willing to make for the good of her family. With her husband's agreement and support, Emily would pick up men at the pub and take them to the back of her husband's van out on the street. She'd only been doing it for a few weeks, since around Christmas time. Most of the time she used the pub to pick up clients, but occasionally she would cruise the streets of Chapel Town in the van looking for men. On the night of the 20th of January 1976, Emily was at one of her favourite pubs to get business in, the Gaiety Pub on Roundtay Road in Leeds. Emily and Sydney had arrived there about 6:15 in the evening, and shortly after that, Emily left to go and find a client. She thought she did find a client in the form of Peter Sutcliffe, who she ran into shortly after 7 p.m. A woman who knew Emily watched her get into a green Land Rover. Emily told Sutcliffe it would cost a fiver and got in his car. They drove half a mile towards the city centre and parked on a piece of derelict land on the Manor Industrial Estate. Here, Sutcliffe struck Emily in the back of the head with a hammer and then dragged her body into the yard. She was then stabbed with a Phillips screwdriver 52 times. Sydney left the pub that night without his wife. When he saw the van still in the car park, he assumed Emily was in the back with the client and, not wanting to disturb her, got a taxi home to wait for her to arrive. Only she never did. Her body was found at 8:10 a.m. the next morning, along with possibly a big clue, a big piece of evidence. On her thigh, through her tights, there was a print of a boot, a size 7 Dunlop Warwick boot. The same boot print was found in the vicinity in the entrance to the Ginnell where she was found. Almost immediately, the pathologist, Professor Gee, made the link to the murder of Wilma McCann, as they bore many similarities. Lacerations to the head caused by blunt instruments, stab wounds done by a Phillips screwdriver, the displacement of the clothing. She was also found only 400 yards from where Wilma had last been seen. On May 9th, 1976, 20-year-old Marcella Claxton was attacked. An attack which at the time wasn't linked to the previous attacks, but would later be after Sutcliffe's arrest and confession. Marcella was left needing extensive brain surgery and 54 stitches after she was attacked by Sutcliffe after she left a house party late at night in Leeds. She was not a sex worker, she says, but did accept a lift home off Sutcliffe when he stopped beside her. He offered her £5 to have sex with him, which she says she refused, but Sutcliffe says she did not. I'm more inclined to believe Marcella here, though, than the serial killer. When Marcella got out of the car, he attacked her over the head with a hammer, masturbated over her while she laid there, and then he just left. She managed to stagger to a nearby phone box to call for help and sat in there whilst emergency services came. Marcella says she watched as this man came back to finish her off, but it doesn't seem like he saw her waiting in the phone box. Like I said, Marcella managed to survive her attack, but she was 4 months pregnant at the time and her baby did not. She managed to give the police a very accurate description of her attacker, but they discounted her case as being linked to the others because she was not a sex worker. She was also subjected to overt racism at the hands of the Leeds police, but despite this, she helped as much as she could with their search because she was sure her attacker would strike again and that it was linked to the other cases. But she was pretty much dismissed every single time. Irene Richardson wouldn't be as lucky to survive. After Marcella, the Ripper didn't strike again for a while, until February 1977. When he did strike, it was in pretty much the exact same spot where Marcella had been attacked. Irene was 28 years old, born and raised in Scotland. When she was 17, she decided to head to London for work, but ended up becoming a single mother and cut all contact with her family. She put her daughter up for adoption. She then moved to Blackpool where her sister lived and met a man called George Richardson where she had another baby, a son, who she put up for adoption once again. George and Irene ended up marrying and having two daughters together who this time they kept, but the relationship was abusive, George was an alcoholic, and Irene suffered really badly with postnatal depression. She ended up fleeing Blackpool and headed back to London before heading to Leeds with the new man she'd met. She was horribly depressed and eventually just ended up homeless, wandering the streets penniless. As far as I could find, there was no real evidence Irene was ever a sex worker, but she may well have been mistaken for one as she wandered the streets, but she had no cautions or convictions for soliciting. Or perhaps she did decide to turn to sex work in her desperation, which is understandable. On the 5th of February, she told people she was heading to a local pub called Tiffany's, but Sutcliffe was out looking for his next victim. Her body was found lying face down the next morning by a jogger. Her throat had been cut deeply, her skull had been smashed in, and her stomach was deeply slashed in three places. A bloody tampon was found lying next to her body, and her tights had semen on them from a non-secretor. Professor Gee announced that he was sure that Irene was murdered by the same person who had murdered Emily and Wilmer. The West Yorkshire Police officially had a serial killer on their hands. The next victim would come just a couple of months later in the form of 32-year-old Patricia Atkinson. She was born and bred in Bradford. She left school aged 15 to work in the textiles industry and married Raman Mitra, having three daughters with him by the age of just 22. She struggled with so much responsibility at such a young age. She was a mother of three and had been married for years already in her early 20s. She started to act out, going socialising alone, and in 1975 would be cautioned by the police for soliciting. This effectively ended her marriage and Ray got custody of the girls. Nobody is really sure why she started as a sex worker, perhaps she just wanted to. But she did give up after being caught by the police and instead started drinking heavily. She struggled for money after the end of her marriage. She ended up living in a small flat in Oak Avenue, Bradford. On the 23rd of April, she got dressed and headed out to the pubs, visiting quite a few that night. She was incredibly drunk by the time she left the Carlisle around 10:15 p.m. and started heading to the International. Whilst Patricia was walking unsteadily down the road and banging on the roof of parked cars shouting obscenities, Sutcliffe drove past. He picked her up and she told him that they could go to her flat, which was local. They drive there and Sutcliffe picks up his hammer as they get out of the car. They go inside, he hangs up his coat and then hits her on the back of the head four times with the hammer. She falls and he picks her up by the arms. He then pulls down her jeans and pulls up her top. He attacks her body using the claw of the hammer to graze her stomach. He also stabbed her six times in the stomach and attempted to stab her on the back. Patricia was found the next morning by a longtime friend who called in on her. When she didn't answer the door, he let himself in and found her on the bed covered in the bedclothes. Investigators later found a bloody footprint on the bedsheet from size 7 Dunlop Warwick boot, matching the prints found at Emily Jackson's murder scene. Although this scene was different, it was indoors, there was undeniably a link. The media's interest in the serial killer had really started to ramp up around this time, calling the murders Jack the Ripper-style slayings, focusing in on the fact that these women were sex workers more than anything else. The public had very limited sympathy for them and therefore didn't really seem all that interested in helping with the investigation. These women deserved what they got. Of course they were going to get murdered, leading such promiscuous lives. That was the narrative until the murder of the next victim, an innocent victim, to die at the hands of the Yorkshire Ripper. Jane MacDonald was just 16 years old when she was murdered on the 26th of June 1977. She had only recently left school and started her first job as a sales assistant in the shoe department of a local shop. She was having a night out with some friends, although she wasn't drinking at all, and whilst out she'd met a boy. Jane and this boy left together with the rest of the group around 10:30 p.m. heading towards Leeds Brigade. They ate some food and Jane was having such a good time that she actually missed her last bus home. So she began to walk home with this boy, parting ways around St James Hospital. Jane started her walk home, reaching the adventure playground on Chapel Town Road. It was here that she was approached and murdered by Peter Sutcliffe, who hit her in the head from behind with a hammer. Her body was discovered by two children at 9:45 the next morning. Investigators said that she'd been stabbed more than 20 times in the front and back, and upon turning her body, they discovered a broken bottle embedded in her chest. In his later confession, Sutcliffe said that he felt terrible about the murder of Jane, saying at the time he believed her to be a sex worker. At this time, the urge to kill prostitutes was very strong and had gone out of my mind, he said.
The public had a similar kind of response. Jane was repeatedly described in the media as an innocent, a respectable young girl. They spoke of how this time the Ripper had made a mistake, that Jane should never have been killed. But weren't all of the victims innocent people who should never have been killed? Before the murder of Jane, this was something that was only happening to sex workers. But this murder of Jane McDonald made the threat real for so many women. 42-year-old Maureen Long was the next victim to survive attacks on July 10th, 1977. She had been out drinking and so had Peter Sutcliffe. At the end of the night, as he was driving, he spotted Maureen coming out of a club called Tiffany's and asked her if she wanted a lift. She said yes and jumped in his car. Once again, Maureen Long was not a sex worker, but Sutcliffe later said that she propositioned him as he dropped her off. But we can't exactly believe his word for anything. Maureen has little memory of this attack after he left her lying on a grass verge after attacking her with a hammer. She was discovered the next morning, miraculously still alive. She had to undergo intense surgery and was given little chance of survival, but she did. Her life from there on out wouldn't be easy though, because she was stuck with the stigma. Even though she had never been a sex worker, just by being a Ripper victim, she was branded as one by the media, and this stigma followed her everywhere she went. For years and years, she was branded as a sex worker in a world that wasn't kind to sex workers, and so she retreated. Due to the extent of her brain injuries, Maureen wasn't ever able to give an accurate description of her attacker. She said he had blonde hair, but we all know that Sutcliffe did not. She tried to help the police as much as she could with their investigation, even going out with them at night to pubs to see if she could recognise the man who attacked her, but she never did. On October 1st, 1977, 20-year-old Jean Jordan was attacked and killed. She was another Scottish woman who had run away from her parents' home in Glasgow when she was just 16 years old. She lived in Manchester and worked in the Moss Side area as a sex worker. She lived with her boyfriend Alan and their children, and when she didn't come home one night, Alan just assumed she'd gone back to Scotland to visit her family. Jean was a bit of a free spirit and would often just disappear off without telling anyone where she was going, so this was kind of normal. In reality though, she'd gone out to work for the night and had come across Peter Sutcliffe. This was the first time he struck in Manchester, probably knowing that the police in Leeds and Bradford were waiting for his next attack. He'd also changed his car in this time. Across the course of his crimes, he'd been seen in a green Land Rover and a white Ford Corsair, and now he'd swapped in for a second-hand red Ford Corsair. He drove to Manchester Moss Side to test it out. Just after 9 p.m, he came across Jean Jordan, who was known as Scotch Jean to friends out on the streets. She was about to get in another car, but chose to go with Sutcliffe instead for the price of £5. Together, they headed to a spot on Princess Road in Chorlton, which is an old allotment area next door to new allotments. It was a very overgrown area, shielded from the traffic of the road. And you can guess what happened once they were there. Jean was murdered with a hammer. But Sutcliffe got interrupted this time. He actually saw a car's headlights come on nearby and quickly pulled Jean's body to a bush to hide it. He realised he was too at risk in this area. It was a place where a lot of couples came, and so he gets in his car and drives away. Jean's body wouldn't be discovered for a number of days until 10th of October, only she wasn't found in the bushes where she'd originally been put. She was found by two allotment holders, only about 20 foot off a well-used pathway near a wooden shed. Jean's body was in a much worse way than any of the other Ripper victims so far. She had been mutilated beyond recognition. And I'm going to spare you the description of what he did to her body because it made me feel sick. Investigators realised pretty quickly that Jean's body hadn't been in the position it was found in for very long. It couldn't have been there for longer than 24 hours, but she'd been dead for longer than 24 hours. The allotment was a busy place, and if the body had been there earlier than that, someone would have noticed. Through that obvious fact, and a lot of other forensic things as well, they deduced that the body had actually been put into a depression near the hedge and covered with a wooden door for many days. But the night before she was found, the killer had returned to the scene for some reason and had mutilated her body and moved her, intending for her to finally be found. It was obvious that this was the work of the Ripper once again, but things were different. The question was, why? Well, it turns out that Sutcliffe, in his haste to leave the crime scene that first night, left a vital piece of evidence behind, something he realised was on the M62 home. He'd given Jean a £5 note as payment that he intended to take back, but he forgot. It was a newly minted note that had been given to him in his pay packet only a couple of days beforehand. He knew he couldn't go back though, so decided to just go home and wait it out. Only Jean wasn't in the paper the next day, nor the day after that. So by the 9th of October, he decided to head back to the scene and search for this note. He thought it would be in a handbag, only the bag was nowhere to be found. Or maybe he did find a handbag and search it, but he didn't find what he was looking for, so he discarded it. I'm not too sure. He stripped her body looking for the note, and when he couldn't find it, in anger, he attacked her corpse again. He was furious, attempting to even decapitate her. He had to leave without the green leather handbag and the £5 note, only for the bag to be found by a member of the public a few days later on the 15th of October. The bag was near the allotments, but sort of over the fence and hidden in the long grass. Even the police had missed it in their fingertip searches. Jean's boyfriend identified this bag as hers, and inside were her belongings, along with a £5 note and a £1 note in the side pockets. Investigators immediately started tracing back the £5 note to whoever had previously owned it, knowing that the killer would have had to have paid Jean for her time. It was obvious that this note was a very new one, it was crisp, and therefore was easy to trace back. The investigators were very smart to pay attention to this £5 note because this is exactly what Peter Sutcliffe was worried about. The Bank of England said that this note had been issued by a sub-branch in Shipley, just outside of Bradford, 4 days before Jean's murder. It was part of a large batch of notes that were split up and paid out to various local businesses and factories to be given as part of workers' wage packets that week. Investigators thought there was a strong chance that the man who had received this fresh note in his wages was likely the Yorkshire Ripper. Of course, there was a chance that it could have exchanged hands in this time, but there was only 4 days, there was a very small chance. If there was a chain, it was a small one. They were one step closer to discovering the killer. Except they didn't release this information to the public until the end of October, when most people had already spent their money from that batch of paychecks. If they could find other notes that had been released in that same batch, they could have narrowed down the search even further, but it was too late. They interviewed about 5,000 people, anyone who could possibly receive that note in their wages. They acknowledged the fact they had probably already looked the killer in the face and spoken to them, but there was no way of narrowing it down. They exhausted this inquiry in the end completely. And it turns out they had interviewed the Yorkshire Ripper, Peter Sutcliffe, not just once, but twice, on November 2nd and 8th. They also spoke to his wife Sonia, and both of them told the same story each time. Peter had been home on the night of October 1st, and they'd been at a housewarming party on the 9th, which they had been. They had been to this housewarming party. The police thought this housewarming was a great alibi, especially when Peter's mum was also interviewed and confirmed that he was definitely there. They found nothing suspicious about Peter and moved on in their inquiry. Turns out Peter had just gone back to Jean Jordan's crime scene after the housewarming party had finished. A month later, 25-year-old Marilyn Moore was attacked in Leeds. She was a sex worker doing business in Chapel Town when a car slowed down next to her. She got in and spoke to a 30-ish-year-old man, stocky build, 5'6" tall, with dark wavy hair and a full beard. I'm happy to say that the reason we have such a good rapport of this man is because Marilyn did survive her attack. She decided to get in his car as she actually saw him waving bye to somebody, so he seemed like a trustworthy client. He said his name was Dave and he spoke about two sex workers that he knew by name, Hillary and Gloria. Marilyn knew them, more reason to trust him. They went to a waste ground in Scott Hall, Leeds, not far from where he'd murdered Wilma McCann 2 years earlier. Upon trying to hit Marilyn with a hammer, he lost his balance and didn't get her with full force, giving her a chance to scream loudly and attract attention. Sutcliffe shouted that she was a dirty prostitute bitch as he continued hitting her and she fell to the ground, but he left, deterred by his screams and a barking dog nearby. Marilyn soon regained consciousness and staggered towards the road to call for help. A couple saw her and called for an ambulance where she was rushed into emergency brain surgery. She was able to give the police a good description of the man who attacked her, despite the level of injury she had received. And the police also found another important clue at her crime scene, this time in the form of tyre tracks. These were consistent with tyre tracks found at the scene of Irene Richardson's murder scene, and therefore there was no doubt that the Ripper was responsible for Marilyn's case also. On the 21st of January 1978, Yvonne Pearson became the next victim. She was just 21 years old, already a mother of two, working the streets to provide for her family. On the night of January 21st, she said goodbye to her kids and left them with a babysitter to go to the pub and go earn some money. In everything that's said about Yvonne online, the number one thing is that she was a great mum. She loved her kids and everything she did was to ensure that she was providing for them as best as she could. She was hard up, but she was trying. She knew that her lifestyle choices were risky, but she didn't really have any other options. She had a court hearing in 5 days' time for a charge of soliciting and had made backup plans for her children's care in case she ended up going to prison because this wasn't her first charge. A lot of the time, these single mums couldn't get 9-to-5 office jobs because they couldn't afford daycare for their children. They had to be at home to care for their children, but how were they going to earn money? Yvonne approached Sutcliffe's car that night, asking him if he was interested. He was, he said, and they agreed on a price of £5. They headed to a waste ground at the back of Drummond's Mill, where once again, we all know what happened. But almost immediately after Sutcliffe started attacking Yvonne, another car pulled in and pulled up alongside him. In a panic, Sutcliffe pulled her body beside an old sofa, grabbing handfuls of horsehair from it and shoving it into her mouth to stop her making noise. He waited, hoping that the person in the car couldn't see what was going on, and it doesn't seem like they did, because eventually they just drove away. At that point, he heard Yvonne Moore kicking and abusing her body. He hit her by covering her in soil and rubble before covering it with the old sofa. She was reported as missing, but people thought that she was simply avoiding her court date, although those close to her knew that this wasn't something she would do. The police did a quick cursory search for Yvonne, but she was gone. Her body wasn't found for another 2 months until the 26th of March, when a passerby saw her arm sticking out from underneath the sofa. Her discovery posed a bit of a mystery for the police, or at least more of a mystery than they were already dealing with. Her head wounds were thought to be caused by a large stone, not a hammer, and there weren't any stab wounds. But her clothing had been arranged in a typical Ripper style, tops pulled up and trousers pulled down. There was also confusion over the date of her death, because a copy of the Daily Mirror, dated February 21st, exactly 1 month after when she would have been murdered, was found underneath her body. Sutcliffe would later deny returning to her body at any point, so how could that have been possible? At first, they didn't think Yvonne's case was connected to the rest, but later they decided it was. Helen Ritker was not much more than a child when she was murdered, only 18 years old on the 31st of January 1978, just 10 days after Yvonne had been killed. Helen had a very difficult life. Her mother wasn't able to care for her and her siblings, so she spent pretty much all of her childhood in care alongside her twin sister Rita. At the age of 18, she was kicked out of the care home she spent her teenage years in, and that was it. She was expected to function as a proper adult. So it's no surprise when her and Rita both turned to sex work to make ends meet. Rita actually did it first, and Helen didn't want her to go through it alone, so she decided to move in with her to this tiny little damp flat, and they said they were going to get through this life together. Whatever Rita did, Helen was going to do as well. They'd only been doing sex work for a few weeks when Helen was killed. Rita would later acknowledge that they knew of the Ripper, but you never think it's going to happen to you. On January 31st, they left their flat at about 8:30 p.m. and got to work, both being picked up by many cars not long after. Helen arrived back first and was ready for her next client, who unluckily for her would be Peter Sutcliffe. She got in the car with him and together they drove to a local timber yard. He hit her with a hammer. At first he missed her, but Helen didn't shout for help at any point. She was on the ground before she realised what was really happening. He bludgeoned her and stabbed her several times, hiding her body behind a stack of timber. Her body would be found 3 days later by a police dog, shoved into a small gap between the timber and a wall, covered with a sheet of asbestos. Vera Millwood was the next victim. She was 40 years old and born in Madrid in Spain. She, like so many of the others, had had a really hard life, moving from Spain to the UK in search of work a couple of decades earlier. Here in the UK, she met Youssef Sultan, who she had 5 children with, but they eventually ended up separating. Vera started working in sex work as a way to supplement her income before meeting Sy Burkett, who was described as her common law husband. They lived together. Together, they had 2 more children, and Vera gave up her sex work. She was plagued with health issues, she had chronic stomach pains, and only 1 lung after a series of operations, and she was aware that she probably didn't have long left to live. On May 16th, 1978, she left the home she shared with Sy, telling him she was going out to get some cigarettes. While some sources say that she was still doing sex work, to which Sy just turned a blind eye, others say she'd quit sometime beforehand due to health issues. But what we do know for sure is that at some point after she left the house, Vera was picked up by Peter Sutcliffe. They drove to a quiet car park near the Manchester Royal Infirmary, and she was killed with hammer blows to the head. Her body was found shortly after 8 a.m. the next morning by workers unloading tools from a van nearby. The scene was out of a typical Ripper scene and had the same tire tracks we'd seen at Irene and Marilyn's crime scenes. After Vera, the Ripper would go unusually quiet. He wouldn't strike again for almost a year, and the victim, Anne Rooney, would manage to survive. She was struck in the back of the head 3 times, caused by a hammer, but had no other injuries. She was not at first thought to be a Ripper victim, as the hammer was different from the usual one used, and her case wouldn't be connected until a 1992 confession. It was with the next murder that it seemed the MO of the Ripper changed. No longer was he going to target only sex workers, but instead any woman. He stopped being fussy. 19-year-old Josephine Whittaker was often described in the papers as a respectable building society girl. Just like Jane McDonald, she was an innocent victim and didn't deserve it. On the 4th of April, Josephine had an argument with her mum over a new watch that she had just bought. Her mum thought that it was too expensive at £60 and told Josephine to take it back, so she headed to her grandparents' house for support. I think that's probably something relatable to a lot of us. If I had an argument with my parents, I could always rely on my grandparents to back me up. It's just the way it is, it's what they're there for. So Josephine spent the evening at her grandparents and they invited her to stay the night, but she wore contacts and left her contacts case at home so she couldn't, and she had to work the next day, so she said she'd just walk home. Her granddad offered to walk her home, but she refused to let him, saying she'd be fine. She knew he had some medical issues. So she just sets off on her own, deciding to walk through Savile Park. Sutcliffe also decided to walk through Savile Park that night, doing a few laps just looking for a victim. He'd reached a point in his crimes where the majority of red light districts in Yorkshire were now overrun with police. It was very risky to find victims there, and many sex workers had started to come up with systems to keep safe. People were paying too much attention, so he had to look elsewhere. He approached Josephine and struck up conversation with her. She told him that she was on her way home from her grandparents and it was quite a walk home. They walked side by side for a while until he attacked her with his usual hammer and screwdriver. He was toeing the line with this murder. As he later said, he almost got caught. There were other people walking in the field, but it was dark and her body wouldn't be found until the next morning by a woman at the nearby bus stop. She ran home to call the police, who arrived soon after. Sadly, Josephine's 13-year-old brother crossed the field in his paper round that morning, intrigued by the police activity as he approached the scene. He saw his sister's shoe there and ran home to tell his parents. They thought that Josephine was in her room after she'd come home late that night, but found that she wasn't. They called the police and it was soon confirmed that Josephine was the victim. Photos taken of Josephine's body at the scene would soon be plastered all over the papers. It was a media frenzy, although her mother and stepfather maintained a dignified silence for decades after they refused to speak to the media. People were shocked opening the papers and seeing Josephine's dead face peeking out from underneath the blanket the police at the scene had attempted to cover her up with. Up until that point, the police and the media had been working somewhat together on this case. The police put out their pleas for public help via the media. They needed each other. But the relationship fell apart soon after this. The papers had gone too far. They didn't assume that Josephine's murder was a Ripper hit at first because she didn't match his usual type. but the stories the injuries told them otherwise. A battered skull, disturbed clothes, stab wounds, it was clearly him. They found some small clues at this scene as well, a milling oil used in engineering shops on her wounds, and a boot print found next to the body which was consistent with the prints found at other scenes. They noted that the boot print showed some wearing and twisting in the centre, probably from the wearer regularly pressing a pedal with the shoe, such as a lorry driver, which we all know Sutcliffe was. It was also said that Josephine had a bite mark on her left breast, a bite mark which showed the killer was someone with a gap between the two upper front teeth. With each murder, the killer was leaving behind more and more clues as to his identity, but investigators couldn't quite piece it all together just yet, although many argue that they should have by now. They'd already interviewed Sutcliffe by this point. It's around this time that the police started receiving communication from someone who claimed to be the Ripper, tapes and letters taunting the authorities for failing to catch him. They came in over the course of a year between March 1978 and June 1979. There were three letters from someone claiming to be the Ripper and a cassette tape introducing himself as Jack. Investigators had reason to believe that all of these communications were genuine from the Ripper himself. The same milling oil found in some of Josephine's wounds were found on the letters. Plus, they thought the information that only the Ripper himself would know was included in these letters. Turns out that a lot more was being leaked to the press than the police realised. Sometimes threats made in the letters would be followed through on. The tape recording was somebody with a clear Geordie accent, someone from Newcastle, which led the investigation away from West Yorkshire. This would have catastrophic consequences. The police being distracted in this time may have led to a delay in the investigation and more deaths. Because of course, this communication wasn't from the actual Ripper. It would be proven through DNA in 2005 that the writer of the letters was a man called John Samuel Humble. He was charged with 4 counts of perverting the course of justice, and he said he did it because he hated the police and had a fascination with Jack the Ripper. He did seem to realise the repercussions of what he was doing though, because just 12 days after the murder of Barbara Leach on 2nd September 1979, he called the police to indicate they were being hoaxed, because he realised what he was doing would affect the investigation and more people would die. But the police received hundreds of calls a day and they didn't pay any attention to this. But throughout this time, the actual Ripper is being interviewed repeatedly. I've already mentioned the first two interviews in 1977, which were in relation with the £5 note. He was then interviewed a third time in August 1978. There had been an operation in the red light district in West Yorkshire to note down cars which were often seen hanging around these areas. The red Ford Corsair that Sutcliffe was driving at the time was seen 7 times in Bradford's red light district. So they called in to interview him once again, disrupting him as he was decorating his kitchen. He said that he often had to drive through the area to get to and from work and denied using sex workers. Sonia backed him up and said that he rarely went out at night. But she did work one night shift a week though, and Sutcliffe, like I said, would later say that the majority of these murders were committed on those nights. They didn't check the tyres on his car, nor note that he'd recently bought another car, a black Sunbeam Rapier. A car that had already been spotted multiple times in another red light district. They realised their mistake a few months later though in the November when they returned to make further inquiries about this car. He'd since sold the Ford Corsair, which they followed through to the new owners, but the new owners had changed the tyres. And then in the July of 1979, over 2 years since he was first interviewed, police turn up on Sutcliffe's doorstep once again, as his new car has been spotted 36 times by Ripper surveillance teams in Bradford, as well as in Leeds and Manchester. This was the first time that Sutcliffe was interviewed and the officers actually noted something strange about his demeanour. Every other time they'd noted that he was just a normal guy, nothing suspicious about him. But now he was acting strange, quiet and evasive. Had these interviewing police officers known that he'd already been interviewed before about the £5 note and about his car being spotted before, this might have been enough to arouse some serious suspicion, but they didn't know that till after the fact. One of the officers did note though that Sutcliffe had a distinctive gap between his front teeth, as had been mentioned by surviving victims, and a bite mark left on a previous victim, and they noted that he was a lorry driver, as they suspected the Ripper was. They made a recommendation at this point that Sutcliffe should be interviewed again by two more senior detectives, making a report for all their suspicions. But this would be pretty much ignored for months due to a massive backlog in the Ripper incident room. Just a few weeks after this, Barbara Leach was murdered on the 2nd of September 1976. She was 20 years old and a university student about to start her final year studying social psychology when she was murdered in the early hours. She was said to be a smart girl, the kind of person who stood up for what she believed was right. On the night she died, Barbara had been out to the Manville Arms pub with some of her friends. They stayed till closing time and then helped the landlord clean up when he thanked them with another drink. The group left the pub at around 12:45 a.m, but Barbara decided she didn't want to head straight home. She wanted to go for a walk and clear her head. But none of her friends wanted to walk with her. They were tired, they wanted to go home. But that wasn't to deter Barbara. She parted from them and headed off on her own. Peter Sutcliffe was driving around that night and watched as Barbara walked away from her friends. He followed her in the car for a bit before getting out and attacking her from behind. He hid her body behind a low wall and covered her body with an old piece of carpet. Barbara's roommates were obviously concerned when she didn't arrive home that night, calling the police to report her missing the following afternoon. It didn't take long for investigators to find her. She was just yards away from her home. After this point, Sutcliffe will be interviewed yet again about his car being seen so many times in red light districts. Now, it's important to know that at this time they were convinced that the person writing the letters to the media and the police claiming to be the Ripper was the real deal. So that's the angle they were focusing in on most. They took a handwriting sample from Sutcliffe to compare with these letters, and when it didn't match, he was eliminated as a suspect. And then in January 1980, police made a second attempt to trace the owner of this all-important £5 note, recreating the conditions on which the money would have been distributed to businesses. Through this, they were able to get a better idea of which businesses received it, narrowing it down to three businesses, including Clark's, where Sutcliffe worked. So he was interviewed again. Despite the report being made back in July 1979 that he should be looked at more closely, it still hadn't worked its way through its system, so nobody really was putting two and two together here. No interviewing officer knew that he'd already been interviewed so many times. He was asked to provide an alibi for the night of Barbara's murder, but was unable to provide one. They searched his house and examined boots and tools found in his garage. But thanks to this lack of communication and the incident room backlog, these officers didn't know about the previous interviews and all the reasons he had to be looked at more closely, so they just kinda left it. Later that month, he was interviewed again for the eighth time now. This time, he was at work whilst he was being interviewed. He was once again asked to explain why his car had been spotted so many times in red light districts, and he said that he was at home on the night of Barbara's murder. Sutcliffe would later say that whilst he was being interviewed, he was literally wearing the same boots he'd been wearing at the murder of Josephine Whittaker, where they found a boot print and the officers didn't even notice. And then just 1 week later, he was interviewed for the final time before his eventual arrest. He was interviewed at work by two detective constables, giving alibis for many of the nights of murders, which Sonia would later back up. Now, I don't think Sonia ever knew what was actually going on, although she's never really spoken to the press. To me, she just seems to be defensive of her husband, and they would remain together for years after he was arrested. But I don't think she actually knew what was going on. I think she was just a bit naive, and a lot of interviewers say that she was just a weird woman anyway. Probably due to feeling like the police were cornering him, Sutcliffe didn't strike again for many months. 353 days after the last attack, on the 20th of August 1980, 47-year-old Marguerite Walls was murdered. She worked at the Department of Education and Science in Pudsey as a civil servant and ended up working late that Wednesday as she was off on holiday for 10 days. She leaves the office between 9:30 and 10:30 p.m. to walk the half mile home. She was spotted walking alone by Sutcliffe, who parked his car and struck her from behind. He changed his MO slightly with Marguerite. He looped a length of rope around her neck to drag her up a nearby driveway and into a garden. He then strangled her and stripped her of all of her clothing before covering her body with grass. Her belongings strewn about this garden were found the next day by two gardeners who called the police, but it was announced fairly quickly that this wasn't the work of the Yorkshire Ripper. Unknown to the police, Sutcliffe had purposely changed his MO here in an attempt to confuse the police and get them off his scent. He was clearly panicking, knowing they were closing in, but also unable to satiate his need to kill. Even when he was first arrested, he refused to admit to Marguerite's murder, but eventually did admit to it in his second statement to the police. After his attack on Marguerite, it seemed that Sutcliffe was unable to restrain for much longer. On the 24th September 1980, he attacked 34-year-old Apadia Badara in Leeds, who luckily managed to survive. Apadia was a doctor from Singapore who was visiting Leeds to attend a course. She visited friends on the night she was attacked and was walking back home alone, having to walk through an alleyway to get there. It was about 10:30 p.m. when she was attacked, hit twice over the head and knocked unconscious. In keeping with the previous murder of Marguerite, a length of rope was looped around her neck and she was dragged down the road after her shoes and handbag were thrown over a wall because they were making too much noise. Luckily, a neighbour heard something was going on and went to investigate and called the police. Sutcliffe fled from the scene and soon Apadia woke up. Like Marguerite's murder, this was not considered to be a ripper attack due to the ligature used. Apadia soon returned to Singapore, where she didn't tell anyone what happened to her in Leeds for a really long time, explaining her scars off as an accident. It wasn't until it hit the worldwide news that the Ripper had been captured did she finally tell her friends and family what she'd really been through. On November 5th, 1980, 16-year-old Teresa Sykes was attacked in Huddersfield. She shared a flat with her boyfriend, who she had a young son with, and on that bonfire night evening, she decided to walk to a local shop to buy some cigarettes. It was about 8 p.m. Peter Sutcliffe watched her from the inside of a telephone box before following her. He struck her on the back with a metal hammer just before she reached her home, but Teresa screamed and was heard by her neighbours and her boyfriend. Sutcliffe started to run, but Teresa's boyfriend Jim was a very fit man and put up one hell of a chase. Sutcliffe ended up hiding in the garden and Jim lost him. Teresa spent weeks after the attack in a specialist neurosurgical unit in Chapel Allerton Hospital in Leeds, but her description of the attacker was off, saying he had a ginger beard. Therefore, the Ripper Squad, which was the name of the investigation team, discounted Teresa's attack as being that of the Ripper, even though the MO did match up. They started to wonder if they had a copycat killer on the loose, now two serial killers roaming the streets of West Yorkshire. They would later realise that it was indeed just one man, it was the Ripper. The final victim of the Yorkshire Ripper was murdered just 12 days after Teresa's attack. 20-year-old Jacqueline Hill was a third-year English student at the Leeds University and a Sunday school teacher. On Monday, the 17th of November, 1980, Jacqueline was returning to her student halls in Headingley when she was attacked. According to Teesside Live, her parents had previously persuaded her to move back to halls for her safety at the height of the Ripper attacks, and she'd obliged. That evening, she'd been at a seminar for probation officers in Leeds City Centre and caught the bus home about 9 p.m. She got off her stop across from the Arndale Shopping Centre at 9:23 p.m. across the road to walk home. This was a busy area. It was a shopping centre in the evening and Sutcliffe was sitting in his car eating a KFC. When he saw Jacqueline, he turned on his car and followed her up the road, waiting for her to pass. As she did, he followed her on foot and then attacked her from behind. He said he almost got caught by another passing woman but managed to drag Jacqueline out of the way. He stabbed her repeatedly with a screwdriver. At around 10 p.m, a student came across Jacqueline's handbag and blood spots, deciding to call the police, who did a quick cursory search but failed to find anything. It wasn't until the following morning that her body was found by a member of the public over a wall. It was soon confirmed that she was a victim of the Yorkshire Ripper, but she was to be the last one, finally. As you can imagine, there was a lot of public outrage about this case, which people rightly felt should have been solved long before it actually was. The police focused intently on the fact that the Ripper murdered sex workers only. The girls he murdered pre-1980 who weren't involved in sex work were just tragic mistakes, innocent victims who the Ripper had targeted accidentally. the non-sex worker victims in 1980 were attributed to a whole different killer. They weren't sex workers, they couldn't possibly be the work of the Ripper. Even the media began to call the police out for their poor handling of the case, which seems to be a bit pot calling kettle black to me, but okay. Feminist groups across Yorkshire began campaigning to end violence against women, not just from the Ripper and people like him, but also the blatant, damaging sexism as demonstrated by the police and the press in this case. As an article in The Guardian points out, George Oldfield, who was leading the Ripper investigation, literally went on TV in 1979 and said, "There may be more pawns in this war before I catch you, but I will catch you." All of these women, particularly the sex workers, were just pawns, disposable pawns to the police. The Ripper was their trophy at the end. Being given the glory of being the man to catch the Yorkshire Ripper is what was pushing them to find him, not the fact that these sex workers were being killed. There were high stakes on this. The reason the Ripper was given his name was because of similarities to the murders of Jack the Ripper back in the 1800s. It seems like somehow people thought catching the Yorkshire Ripper would be a kind of vindication for London's failure to ever catch Jack. There's no denying there were so many mistakes made in this investigation. Sutcliffe should have been caught so much earlier than he was. So many lives could have been saved if investigators just paid attention and connected the dots. The Ripper incident room used a poor system, a card index system that was never properly cross-referenced. Evidence got lost time and time again. Sutcliffe, like I said, was interviewed 9 times over the course of this investigation. His car was seen repeatedly in red light areas. He matched physical descriptions given by so many of the survivors. He was a lorry driver, just as they suspected. And it was acknowledged that he could have been the one to receive the £5 note found at Jean Jordan's crime scene. Despite 2.5 million man hours dedicated to this case by the police, the Ripper was caught by chance. Even Sutcliffe said at his trial, "It was just a miracle they didn't apprehend me earlier. They had all the facts." The biggest blunder in this case was the hoax tape and letters sent by what was later called the Sunderland Hoaxer. George Oldfield believed 100% that this wasn't a hoax. He was sure that this was real communication from the Ripper, and this led the investigation so far from where it should have been. They stopped even looking in Yorkshire, looking further afield for their man, and it distracted them at a vital point in the investigation. Earlier in the video, I mentioned Trevor Birdsall, the man or friend who was with Sutcliffe when he committed his first stone and sock attack. They remained good friends until around 1972 when they drifted apart due to Trevor getting married, although they did still see each other occasionally in the years after. Trevor's suspicions did not come to the forefront until he saw reports of the murder of Jacqueline Hill in November 1980. He had recently been out with Sutcliffe in his Rover 3.5 saloon and made the connection to reports of a dark square saloon car seen near Jacqueline's murder. Knowing Sutcliffe's history of hatred of prostitutes, all of the links to Sutcliffe could no longer be ignored. So on the 25th of November 1980, Trevor Birdsall wrote a letter to the Ripper incident room in Leeds, writing, "To whom it may concern, I'm writing to inform you that I have every good reason to believe I know the man you're looking for in the Ripper case. It is an incident which happened within the last 5 years. I cannot give any date or place any details without myself being known to the Ripper, or you if this is the man. It is only until recently that something came to my notice, and now a lot of things fit into place. I can only tell you 1 to 2 things which fit, for example. This man has had dealings with prostitutes and always had a thing about them. Also, he is a long distance lorry driver, collecting engineering items, etc. I'm quite sure if you check up on dates, etc., you may find something. His name and address is Peter Sutcliffe, 5 Garden Lane, Heaton, Bradford." This was just one letter of many that appeared at the incident room, and police had to prioritise. Birdsall's letter was marked as action to trace or interview Sutcliffe, priority number one. They made action to trace him, they didn't get around to it. At the time of Jacqueline Hill's murder, his last victim, the police had a league table of suspects, names they thought could be guilty. They divided the suspects into 3 divisions. Division 1 had 26 names. Apparently the name at the top of the list was a taxi driver who they spent months tailing. He was clearly innocent. Division 2 had 200 names and Division 3 had 1,000 names, including Peter Sutcliffe. Despite all of the clues pointing towards him, his name was barely a thought. That is until 46 days after the murder of Jaclyn Hill, Friday the 2nd of January 1981. Sutcliffe left his home just after 4 p.m. and drove to a scrapyard just outside of Leeds where he picked up two number plates. He called Sonia about 9 p.m. to say he was having car troubles that he wouldn't be home until later. He then affixed the stolen number plates over those of his Land Rover and started driving around the red light district of Havelock Square in Sheffield. He picked up a 24-year-old woman called Olivia Reavers. She got in his car and they headed to a place to have sex, the driveway of the Light Trades house. They tried to, but he couldn't get an erection. Clearly Sutcliffe, for all of his hatred of sex workers, did actually use them. That night, Sergeant Robert Ring and Constable Robert Hyde had just started their shift. At 10:30, they were cruising the area when they noticed a dark, square-shaped car parked at the driveway of the Light Trades house. They knew why it was there, they knew the places people took sex workers, so they approached the car. As Hyde approaches, Sutcliffe tells Olivia to pretend to be his girlfriend. He introduced himself to the officer as Peter Williams. Whilst they spoke, Ring was running the number plates, which soon came back as being false. At this point, Sutcliffe realised that he was being backed into a corner. He grabs his hammer and knife hidden under his car seat and heads over to a stone porch, telling the officers that he was bursting for a pee. He hides his tools and then heads back to his car. The officers take Sutcliffe and Olivia to the Hamilton Road police station where he asks to use the toilet again. He had a knife in his jacket which was only accessible through a hole in his pocket, which he knew he had to get rid of, so he drops it into the cistern of the toilet. He also still had a length of rope in his pocket, the same one he'd been using for his more recent crimes. When interviewed, he told them that his real name was Peter Sutcliffe and explained that he was using fake plates in his car because he was due in court on a drunk driving charge. He admitted that he stole them from a scrapyard near Murfield and then was sent to a cell to sleep. As he had stolen the plates from Murfield, it was actually up to Dewsbury PD to handle the charge as it was under their jurisdiction. So an officer from Dewsbury said they'd come collect him around 6 a.m. Now, usually such a minor theft charge would mean he would be released on bail almost immediately. However, the police were very aware that they had the eyes of the country on them and they had been failing miserably lately. At the scene of Jaclyn's murder, police missed some very important evidence due to a poorly done search, and so it was ordered by the chief constable that any man found with sex workers in suspicious circumstances was to be brought to the attention of the Ripper Squad. Thank God for that, because we all know that the name Peter Sutcliffe was one that was well known to the Ripper Squad by this point. And he actually just plain admitted in his interview at Dewsbury that he had been looked at in connection with the Ripper case before. The interviewing officers noticed that he matched many of the descriptions of the Ripper by surviving victims. At about noon, a detective Sergeant O'Boyle interviewed Sutcliffe again, introduced himself as a member of the Ripper Squad. He begins the interview trying to get an idea of the man sat in front of him. Why would this guy be more likely to be the Yorkshire Ripper than any other person on their list? He's questioned about the number plates, he's questioned about how often he has sex with his wife, and he's asked to give a blood sample, which he balks at first, but then agrees to when O'Boyle asks him what he has to be so scared of if he's not the Ripper. Of course, his blood type showed that he had B-type blood, just like the Ripper did. But still, they very, very nearly released him. They just didn't believe that he was the Ripper. But the chief superintendent wasn't so convinced it could still be him, so he sends in a higher-ranking officer to interview, this time Detective Inspector John Boyle, not to be confused with O'Boyle from before. They go in harder. He's questioned about the times his car had been seen in red light areas, he's questioned about where he was on the night of Jaclyn Hill's murder. He said he believed he was at home with his wife, and then he was told that his wife was also going to be brought in for questioning. It's said that Sutcliffe was very calm, cooperative and pleasant throughout all of the interviews. By 10 p.m. the interviews end and back in Sheffield, Sergeant Robert Ring, one of the arresting officers, hears that this random man he arrested 24 hours earlier is still being questioned by Ripper detectives no less. So he remembers something which would change the course of the entire investigation. He remembered how Sutcliffe had briefly walked away to pee, so he decides to go exploring. And what does he find? The hammer and knife that Sutcliffe had disposed of the day before. By 11:05 p.m, the Ripper Squad were being informed of this discovery and they were on their way to Sheffield. They finally had him. The next morning, Sutcliffe's house was being searched. They removed a number of tools from the home. They also searched his car and took Sonia in questioning as well. She would be questioned for 10 hours. And Sutcliffe was prepared for another day of questioning himself. He's asked about specific nights, specific murders, and unbeknownst to him, Sonia's in the same building, giving completely different accounts of those nights. Their stories didn't match up. He's taken on a line of questioning about his movement on the night he was arrested, eventually leading up to the moment he went to urinate against a wall. Sutcliffe realised that he'd been caught. Boyle says, "Do you understand what I'm saying? I think you're in trouble, serious trouble." Sutcliffe responds, "I think you've been leading up to it," which Boyle says, "Leading up to what?" Sutcliffe replies, "The Yorkshire Ripper. Well, it's me." When he's given the option for a solicitor, he responds, "No, I don't need one. I just want to tell you what I've done. I'm glad it's all over. I would have killed that girl in Sheffield if I hadn't been caught, but I'd like to tell my wife myself. I don't want her to hear about it from anyone else. It's her I'm thinking about and my family. I'm not bothered about myself." He then goes on to give a full confession, which I've referenced several times in this video. He gave his initial confession and then more in a further statement later in the month. He admitted to 11 murders at first and denied being the author of the letters. He said that whilst all the letter stuff was going on, he felt safe, like he wasn't going to get caught. It was something for him to hide behind. He wasn't a Geordie, he was born in Shipley. He was officially charged with the murder of Jacqueline Hill and the theft of the number plates at Dewsbury Magistrates Court on the 5th of January 1981. And then the further 12 murders on the 20th of February, along with 7 charges of attempted murder. On the 14th of April, the case was transferred to the Old Bailey in London for the trial. Nobody believed that he'd be able to get a fair hearing that he was entitled to in Yorkshire. They would not be able to get an impartial jury on this case. It affected everyone. The preliminary trial would begin on the 29th of April 1981, where Peter Sutcliffe pled not guilty to murder, but guilty to manslaughter on the grounds of diminished responsibility. 4 different psychiatrists diagnosed him with paranoid schizophrenia, and the prosecution initially intended to accept this plea, but the trial judge demanded an unusually detailed explanation of why the prosecution were going to do this. After 2 whole hours of explanation, the judge, Justice Sir Leslie Boreham, rejected the diminished responsibility plea and said the trial was going to go ahead with the jury to begin on the 5th of May. The trial lasted for 15 days, and I could go into full detail here, but to be honest, nothing much really came up in the trial that I haven't already covered in this video. The prosecution argued that Sutcliffe wasn't a paranoid schizophrenic at all, that he was just very skilled at pulling the wool over people's eyes and had done just that to his doctors. They argued that he was a callous murderer, which he was. He thought that if he convinced people he was mad, then he might get 10 years in the loony bin at most, or so he was overheard saying to his wife. He said that he had a message from God to kill sex workers, and apparently that's what he was doing. It was a divine mission. Something which he actually only made reference to on his 8th interview 2 months after his arrest. So he had time to come up with this excuse. The jury in this case weren't necessarily there to determine his guilt or innocence. They were there to determine his mental state. Throughout the trial, Sutcliffe showed absolutely no emotion. He just sat there, as if being on trial for murder was an everyday occurrence for him. On the 22nd of May, the jury found Peter Sutcliffe to be guilty on 13 counts of murder. They didn't believe he was insane. He knew what he was doing. He was also found guilty on 7 counts of attempted murder and was sentenced to life imprisonment with a minimum of 30 years. Justice Sir Leslie Boreham said, "Peter William Sutcliffe, the jury found you guilty of 13 charges of murder, and if I may say so, murder of a very cowardly quality. It is difficult to find words that are adequate in my judgment to describe the brutality and the gravity of these offences, and I say at once I'm not going to pause to seek those words. I am prepared to let the catalogue of your crimes speak for itself. I have no doubts that you are a very dangerous man indeed." He added, "The sentence for murder is laid down by the law and is immutable. It is a sentence that you be imprisoned for life." The judge also went on to commend the 2 uniformed officers who had arrested Sutcliffe that day and Olivia Reavers, the sex worker he was found with. He said, they are engaged in what I suspect from what I heard sitting in this court is often a very humdrum routine duty. They must be very grateful, and the public in general, and Miss Reavers in particular, must be very relieved that these basic police tasks which they perform were carried out assiduously and with such attention to duty. He also commended Sergeant Ring for having the thought to return and search the scene of the crime, for without him doing that, there's a chance Sutcliffe may have been set free to kill again. He's sent to Pankhurst Prison on the Isle of Wight, where he spends 3 years. But after 3 years, it seems that the psychiatrists at his trial were correct. He was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia once again and is sent to the Secure Psychiatric Hospital, Broadmoor, which is where he'd spend the next 3 decades. In 2010, Sutcliffe filed an appeal for a minimum term to be set to make it possible for him to get parole. This was heard by the High Court in July 2010, when it was decided that he would never be released. And then he appealed that ruling, which was once again rejected. The justice said that the time that passed since his 1981 trial did not mean that his crimes and his account of the crimes were any less credible now. He still did the things he did, he's still a dangerous individual, and he should never, ever be released. He was said to die in prison. Which is exactly what he did, aged 74, on the 13th of November 2020. He'd been suffering with poor health for many, many years with many underlying health problems, so it wasn't a surprise when he died from COVID-19, for which he had refused treatment. Good riddance, and I'm sure a huge relief for the families of many of his victims. As you can imagine, there was a lot of criticism of the police in the aftermath of Sutcliffe's capture. He should have been caught much, much earlier than he was. After the fact, 2 different inquiries were set up to determine where everything had gone wrong and to ensure it never happened again. The most famous of which is the Byford Report, named after the Inspector of Constabulary, Lawrence Byford. The Byford Report was actually only released to the public in 2006, and I'll make sure it's linked down below in case anyone is interested and wants to have a read. But it was actually published to the House of Commons in 1981, the same year as the trial, the same year he was caught. It was a scathing look at all of the mistakes which had been made in the investigation, and it found that detectives had made major errors of judgment in the 5 years that Sutcliffe was free to roam the streets. And it led to huge changes in investigative procedures across the country. Byford acknowledged that most officers in the case worked diligently and conscientiously throughout the investigation, but the investigation as a whole was a failure. Sutcliffe could have been caught at least 18 months before he was arrested, and many lives could have been saved. Byford made a number of recommendations to ensure this failure never happened again, including, but not limited to, standardisation of the procedures for major incident rooms, computerisation of records, better training of senior investigating officers, advisory teams, and for the media and the police to work better together. Arrangements between the two should have been made, but instead the police got mad at the media got mad at the police, and it just led to everything going wrong. This was the largest criminal investigation ever conducted in the UK, and hopefully we will never have to deal with something of this scale ever again. But if we do have to, then the Byford Report should be followed carefully to ensure that more lives are not lost and can be helped.
Thank you so much for tuning into this week's episode of Mysteries and Histories. If you have a bit of time, I would love for you to go and leave a review wherever you're listening to this podcast and spread the word. It would be much appreciated. I'll see you next week.